Our third case of the morning is number 034107, Osler Institute Incorporated against Lois Ford.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, my name is Curtis McCauley. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellate in this matter, the Osler Institute, Inc. With me today is at counsel's table is Brian Paul, my associate, and also in the gallery today is Dr. Joseph Seligan, the founder and president of the Osler Institute, Inc. The issue presented in this case is a fairly discreet one. It involves a two-page agreement between the parties to this lawsuit that was the subject of a sua sponte summary judgment entered against the Osler Institute in which substantial portions of that contract were invalidated as unenforceable by the district court. And the issue before the court today is whether some of the ancillary provisions, in particular the attorney fee clause, survives that gutting of the contract that occurred at the summary judgment stage. Very briefly, the factual background is the Osler Institute is a nonprofit Indiana corporation. It offers test prep courses to doctors who are seeking their medical board certifications. The our defendant in this case was Lois Ford. She was hired by Osler in 1995 to help assist in putting on these courses in various locations around the United States. When she was hired, Lois Ford signed a two-page employment agreement, the principal provisions of which were non-competition prohibitions, non-solicitation of clients provisions, and a trade secrets provision. Lois Ford left Osler after working for it for about 5 years in April 2000, and shortly thereafter started working for an upstart competitor of Osler called PhiPrep. She, in fact, became a part owner of that company, investing $10,000 in it. PhiPrep hired former Osler lecturers, and as a result, Osler decided to sue under the terms of the agreement with Lois Ford, particularly under the non-competition and non-solicitation of clients provisions. There were four counts to this lawsuit that were filed. The first was for breach of the agreement. The second was for breach of fiduciary duties. The third claim was for tortious interference, which pertained to her involvement in hiring former lecturers for Osler to work for the competitor, PhiPrep. And the last issue, our claim, was for slander. The district court judge, Judge McKinney, entered a sua sponte summary judgment against the Osler.
We're really all familiar with that background here. There's a very limited amount of time to argue, and I'm interested in your position that the attorney fees provision of this contract is unenforceable.
Let me jump right into it. I thought that the background would be helpful in understanding, because it is what the judge did to the contract that leads to the situation that we're in now. The judge essentially found that the non-competition and the non-solicitation of clients provisions were unenforceable. The judge also found that there weren't any trade secrets that Ms. Ford came into contact with, and basically found that for that reason would not enter any injunctive relief, would not award any damages for violation of those provisions. The court essentially found that those provisions were in fact void. After an appeal, we came back. The attorneys for Lois Ford asked for their attorney fees under the attorney fee clause, and the judge awarded those. Our position is that once the contract, the essential provisions of the contract have been voided and cut out, the entire contract goes. You can't gut everything that really matters.
Doesn't the contract itself provide for separation or severability?
Yeah, it does, but the severability clause does not necessarily save the contract. The purpose of the severability clause, generally understood, to save the rest of the contract when only small parts of it have been excised here.
Is that right?
Yes. That's correct. We've cited...
Couldn't you spell out if you're drafting a contract that in the event A is held to be not functional, and the contract is void in its entirety?
I don't think that's always done. I mean, you can look at...
I'm sure it's not always done, but why is it the one thing that says if one part is found void, the rest of it is still good?
Well, if you look at the severability clause in this case...
Yes.
The severability clause in this case recites what is basically what you would find in a stock severability clause, and then goes on and hits the more, the most important part, and what seems to be the indication of what the party's intent for severability was. If this, non-compete agreement is found overly broad in any particular way, it ought to be narrowed so that it can be enforceable.
Right.
It does not indicate that the parties contemplated that if the entire contract or the entire provisions that had any substantive force in effect here were thrown out, that the rest of the contract...
Well, part of the thing that wasn't thrown out was the right to collect attorney's fees.
That's right. But that was certainly not the fundamental purpose of the contract. The Indiana Supreme Court's decision in Harbor controls this case.
Uh-huh.
And
that Harbor case involved an illegal contract, vehicle rental agreement that was illegal. This was a non-compete clause is not illegal. It turned out to be unenforceable, too broad, or not limited in time.
Well, I don't think that there's any meaningful distinction for the purposes of Harbor and the analysis that it undergoes, which is to look to what the parties would have intended if they had, thought about this to begin with. And the issue is that the substantive provisions of the agreement, whether, they are thrown out on the basis that they are quote-unquote illegal or void as unenforceable as against public policy, it's the same issue. Would the parties had intended that the rest of the agreement, these minor ancillary parts, somehow survive that? Would the parties have ever entered into an agreement, where you took off the entire first page like this and left it with, provisions here that really have no substantive force in effect? And Harbor indicates that...
I don't know why it's so hard to believe that somebody would enter into an agreement that if you sue me and lose, I get my attorney's fees.
Well, yes, if that's what they had talked about to begin with. If somebody came and approached that, you could have that agreement. The point is that's not the agreement that they entered into. Presumably, when they signed this, the parties intended to honor it. They weren't contemplating that I'm signing a contract, the full first part of which doesn't matter, and the only thing that's going to be enforceable is this attorney fee provision at the end. I mean, look at the absurd result that it leads here. I mean, the Osler Institute is being asked to pay Lois Ford's attorney's fees after Lois Ford signed an agreement promising not to do something, then did what she promised not to do, then came into court and said, look, even though I promised not
well,
to
then
do it...
she was brought into court. Well, you sued her.
Well, she came
and
into court...
And provided that if you sue her, she gets her attorney's fees if you lose.
Well, she came into court as part of the lawsuit and made the argument that I didn't have to honor my promise because it was void. And the point is that did Osler agree or intend that, Lois Ford should come into court and say, the first part of it, all the agreement that applies to me doesn't matter. I don't have any obligations to do or not to do the things I agreed not to do. However, the attorney fee provision, which favors me, in retrospect, after it's all said and done, well, now wait, I don't mean to throw out the entire contract. I want to keep the attorney fee. What's that?
And what you're saying is that provision is not appropriate because she defended the lawsuit that you brought.
Yes. Yeah. But the point is,
if she defends the lawsuit, then the provision for her to get the attorney fees if she wins the lawsuit is void, according to your position.
Yes, because she has to accept the consequences
anyway,
of her argument, which is if I'm going to defend not on the grounds that I avoided doing what I agreed not to do, but on the basis that there really wasn't a contract that's enforceable, then she should live with the consequences of that argument, which is that there is no longer any attorney fees provision.
Mm.
I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCauley. We'll hear now from Mr. McKee.
Thank you, Judge Ripple. May it please the court, my name is Craig McKee, and I represent Lois Ford. As I alluded to in the brief, the argument that Osler Institute presents today is the quintessential heads I win, tails you lose argument. And as the court has already alluded to in its questions today, we take the position that the contract, denominated an employment contract, that was presented to Lois Ford when she became employed by Osler Institute, and which contained many provisions in it, including a non-compete covenant and a trade secrets and a proprietary information provision, but there are other provisions in that employment agreement, provided a very broad attorney fee provision that we have sought to enforce. Now this panel, I don't know whether by coincidence or intention, is the identical panel that heard the earlier appeal.
Yes.
So you're well aware of what transpired in this case on the merits. And what I suspect what we're doing here, to some degree in this appeal, is an attempt to retry the unsuccessful effort to prevail on the merits. And that's not appropriate. That case has been decided from the Terre Haute Division to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we have suggested in our brief, and the position that we have taken, is that Judge McKinney's opinion in the sua sponte summary judgment, and that was ultimately affirmed by Judge Evans' opinion in this court, simply held that Osler Institute could not establish, as a matter of proof, that Lois Ford was in possession of any protectable information. That does not mean that she would not have been bound by the employment agreement if, in fact, in the course of performing her responsibilities, she came into possession of proprietary information or trade secrets or matters which would be protectable by a covenant or those provisions under Indiana law. This was a proof problem, not a public policy issue. I have reread Judge McKinney's original opinion many times in an effort to find what was held to be illegal, as in the Harbor case, or what was held to be a violation of public policy. There's no indication here that the covenant itself as written, or these provisions as written, violate Indiana law in terms of territoriality, in terms of time, in terms of the traditional matters by which a covenant of this kind is analyzed. Covenants not to compete are written and enforced every day under Indiana law. So Judge McKinney then, in considering this attorney fee position, had an opportunity to consider exactly this same argument presented to the court today as an opportunity to say, Judge McKinney, you essentially voided this contract in its entirety in your original opinion, did you not? And Judge McKinney specifically rejected that argument and found in his order on the attorney fee petition that the non-competition clause, or his determination that the non-competition clause was void, that is, empty, did not vitiate the remaining terms of the contract. But even more, Judge McKinney specifically found that the severability provision, as Judge Bauer observed, in any event, would have saved this provision. And thirdly, there was yet another basis to do this, and that is the breadth of the attorney fee provision itself. Now that provision, as the court has read, would entail any sort of litigation between these parties, not just those exclusively on this contract. Now, as counsel has already observed and as the court is aware, the original lawsuit filed by Osler against Ford was not confined to the contract. That was one of four counts. The remaining counts dealt with a breach of fiduciary duty, dealt with the tort of interference with business relations, and the tort of slander. And Judge McKinney considered all of those, as did this court, in the original decision on the merits, and rejected them all. The attorney fee provision itself contemplates not just litigation that derives from the contract, but deals with any kind of litigation. Therefore, one would presume, the way it's written, that had Lois Ford filed an employment discrimination suit, or an age discrimination suit, or perhaps even a workers' compensation claim, and had not prevailed, this very same provision would have been used by Osler to contend that when she failed to prevail against them, that she owed them their attorney's fees. So the parties here have a very different take on what Judge McKinney's original decision said on the merits. We simply contend, and I think it's plain in Judge McKinney's original opinion, that those provisions over which the parties contested the claim on the merits were void, as in empty or not applicable. Ulster here, as I indicated earlier, specifically claims that Judge McKinney's opinion found that the covenants violated Indiana common law and public policy. In rereading Judge McKinney's opinion, I find no such language, and I don't think it's a reasonable inference, either from his opinion or from the opinion of this court in considering that case on appeal. This contract was specifically determined by Judge McKinney to be mutual in nature, and it contained more clauses than this kind of one-sided, selfish reading that Osler Institute presents here. The underlying case, as I observed earlier, dealt with multiple theories of recovery, and Lois Ford was compelled to defend on multiple theories of recovery. It was not exclusively a contractual violation. Now, we're told in the reply brief that that's question begging because a rational economic actor would not have entered into this contract had they known that these provisions would be voided. I would contend, quite the contrary, that had Lois Ford been entrusted with information that was proprietary or was not a part of the public domain, which this court observed and Judge McKinney observed, she was in possession of no information that was not in the public domain, that they certainly could have sued to enforce that, and had they been in a position to prove that Ms. Ford was in possession of that information and had misused it in some way, then they would have been in a position to recover. This is a proof problem, not a public policy problem. Finally, we think that the plain language of the contract and the attorney fee provision set forth that Lois Ford is a prevailing party, that the litigation was, and I quote, related in any way to Ford's employment by Osler. I mean, that is as broad an attorney fee provision as I suspect can be drafted. If those two facts are in play, as they are here, then she is entitled to be reimbursed by Osler for her reasonable attorney's fees. Judge McKinney considered the brief, considered the petition that was submitted on behalf of Ms. Ford, adjusted that. I think there was some dispute about what costs were recoverable or not, and then entered an order granting the petition and awarding attorney's fees. So, in summary, Lois Ford has been a prevailing party from the Terre Haute Division to the U.S. Supreme Court, and now on a second trip in this court, she seeks to prevail again. She's entitled to the attorney's fees that were promised in the employment contract that was thrust before her by her employer, an employer that ultimately fired her, sued her, and lost. For those reasons, the district court opinion should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. McKee.
Thank you, Judge Ripple.
How much time does Mr. McCauley have? Thank you.
As quick as I possibly can. This isn't heads I win, tails you lose, Your Honor. If she had proved that she hadn't breached the contract and didn't attack the contract, she would have been entitled to her attorney fees. The trial court here definitely voided this contract. There can be no doubt about it. Read the judge's decision. At least three or four times, the judge says the contract is void. In fact, the judge threw out the breach of fiduciary duty count on the basis that there was no contract between the parties from which a fiduciary duty could be found. And that was because the court voided the contract. As to the severability issue, I think in the scope and meaning of a severability clause, I'd encourage you to look at the Third Circuit decision in Alexander, which we cite in our briefs, which explained that the severability clause there did not save an agreement after many of the provisions had been thrown out on the basis of unenforceability. It's plain that the court here voided the contract and didn't just find that it didn't apply. The contract specifically said you cannot compete. She competed. It wasn't you can't compete if you get trade secret information or come into possession of it, or you can't compete if you have this, this, and this. It was just basically you cannot compete. So the fact of the matter is that it was voided. It was never enforceable. It wasn't that it just didn't apply to her. And finally, this whole argument about the breadth of the attorney fee provision is really just it's a canard because the point of it puts the cart before the horse. Question is there an attorney fee provision to enforce? And our position, as we set out in our brief, is that the contract was so gutted that there's no attorney fee provision left there.
Thank you, Mr. McCauley. Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.